This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to Talk Louisiana. As the state of Florida surveys the damage from Hurricane Irma, we are now going to examine many issues in our world, including climate change, and that brings us to our leadoff guest, Peter Kalmus. He's a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory with a PhD in physics from Columbia. At work, he studies the physics of clouds and a changing climate, and at home, he explores how we can address climate change while living happier, more connected lives. He's written a book about his experience of cutting his consumption of fossil fuels to one-tenth of the average American. It's called Being the Change, Live Well, and Spark a Climate Revolution. And for those who've been following the events of the world over the last few days, in a Saturday story front page of the New York Times, Henry Fountain puts it this way: vicious hurricanes all in a row, one having swamped Houston, another buzzing through Florida after ripping up the Caribbean, wildfires bursting out all over the West after a season of scorching hot temperatures and years of dryness. And late Thursday night off the coast of Mexico, a monster of an earthquake. You could be forgiven for thinking apocalyptic thoughts like the science fiction writer John Scalzi, who, surveying the charred and flooded and shaken landscape, declared on Twitter, "Sure as hell feels like the end times are getting a few dress rehearsals right about now." 877-217-5757 is your number. Your Baton Rouge dial is 297-5633. And Ali Baltazar is our producer. If you'd like to send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Peter Kalmus, good morning to you from California, where you're getting an early start to talk with us. Good morning.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's very nice to hear your voice. What's your take right now on how important an issue it is as far as the world's future with the world at large addressing climate change?
Well, I should preface all my statements by saying that I'm speaking on my own behalf. And I would say that it's one of the two most important issues that we face right now. You know, if it wasn't for the crisis in North Korea, I would say it's clearly the most important issue. The difference between those two issues is that climate change is certain, and it's here now, and it's certainly getting worse, and it's not going to go away on its own. You know, until we take coordinated, concerted action, the kinds of disasters that you just mentioned are only going to get worse. So what we have isn't a new normal. It's a sort of a changing normal.
Peter Kalmus is our guest. He's a NASA scientist and an authority on climate change. He lives in suburban Los Angeles with his wife and two children, and does so on one-tenth the average fossil fuel consumption of an American. Now, you're in Los Angeles, which, of course, is a city that thrives on automobiles and freeways, and yet you do this. I'm not sure how, but why did you embark on this path in life?
Well, as my awareness of what was happening and the connection between burning fossil fuels and global warming, and the fact, I think it's a clear fact that you know, global warming is causing suffering and causing devastation and causing death. And I think that, you know, the world is, the recent events are helping people wake up to that that clear connection. So, you know, over the last decade, as my own awareness of this increased, I just decided that, you know, I would look at something that I was doing, like getting on an airplane flight, and I'd weigh the harm that I knew that was causing to my children, to other people, against whatever benefit that flight was going to give me. And eventually I just realized that the harm outweighed the benefit. So I started looking for creative ways to reduce my own emissions just because of that that connection. You know, I don't want to be part of the problem. I don't want to dig the hole deeper. And you know, what I found that was interesting and which led to my writing the book was that this didn't make my life less satisfying or less fulfilling. In fact, the opposite. You know, I got more involved in my community. I started growing food, which is something that I'd never done in my life. And I just love it now. I just love gardening and having fruit trees and orchards. And so, you know, I thought that message wasn't being spread enough, and that's what led me to write the book, that we can actually live more satisfying lives on less fossil fuel.
We're hearing the voice of Dr. Peter Kalmus, atmospheric scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He is speaking today on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA or the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and the book is Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, and he practices what he preaches, alarmed by drastic changes in the Earth's climate system. He began by bicycling, growing food, meditating, making other simple, fulfilling changes, and ultimately slashed his climate impact to under a tenth of the U.S. average. And you say you became happier in the process.
Well, yeah, so there's a lot of reasons for that. Kind of the most obvious one is just a lot of these actions are, you know, kind of joyful in and of themselves. Like, for me, JFK once said that nothing compares to the simple pleasure of riding a bike, and I definitely get that. I just love the feeling of flying down the street under my own power. But it goes deeper than that, because this is the crisis of our times, global warming, and to actually start to pioneer a new life without fossil fuels, and in doing so, hopefully to make that seem less strange to my neighbors and mm-hmm. my friends, and to start to shift the culture by speaking out about it and letting people know that it's not as bad as they might think, that feels deeply meaningful. And then there's maybe an even deeper, you know, meaningful work is a great joy. And then maybe there's something even deeper, which is that, you know, when you have a particular principle, when there's some way that you think it kind of is a good way of living, you know, for me, it's not wanting to harm others. When you actually, it's hard to actually live by one's principles, right? But when you start to change your outward actions to be aligned with what you believe deep inside, then I think that actually makes you happier.
877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on the air with Dr. Peter Kalmus.
Good morning, gentlemen. Jim, let me first say, last week you had a gentleman on, a weather guy, who said, when I brought up what Bob Marshall of the New Orleans Picayune has written, by the end of the century, sea level could rise 5 or 6 feet. Everything south of U.S. 90, Louisiana, will be underwater. He said, well, they need to move the city to the north. Well, I'd like to know, how do we move one of the world's greatest marine estuaries, South Louisiana, which produces an abundant amount of shrimp, crabs, oysters, fish, how do you move that north of U.S. 90? And your gentleman guest may have read an op-ed piece in the New York Times by Christy Todd Whitman, which was an extraordinary piece of information, and she's claiming that the Trump administration is doing nothing to protect the health or the environment of the people in the United States. But real easy, this climate change, just to understand. NASA can observe the infrared radiation from the Earth being reflected into the atmosphere, absorbed by CO2. From the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, if you graph the temperature of the Earth decade by decade, temperatures have increased. It is simple ABC logic that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and right. On the path we're headed right now, there'll be massive sea level rise. Plankton in the ocean will be destroyed because the oceans are being acidified by the carbon, and the Earth is on a doomsday scenario.
All right. Well, do you respond, Dr. Kalmus? David in Atlanta gave you much to work with, but I suspect you're in concurrence on most, if not all, of what he said.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've known the basic underlying physics of global warming for over 100 years. You know, the basics of the greenhouse effect, it's pretty simple physics. You have a gas that, you know, has certain vibrational modes, and it can interact with photons. So these are infrared photons coming up from the planet's surface, you know, and it can absorb those and re-emit them. And the more of that gas you have, the less of that can escape to space. We've known the basics for a long time. I think most climate scientists feel a deep sense of frustration that, you know, something that we know so well, and the evidence is just so interconnected. There's so many different lines of evidence, you know, from heat building up in the ocean to surface temperatures measured on over land and over the ocean, from satellites, from ground stations, to melting ice, to, you know, thermally expanding oceans that, you know, are acting as we expect them to act. So there's just, the evidence is overwhelming. And for, you know, for politicians in this country to be denying that, it's just kind of flabbergasting to us, I think. So, yeah, I feel David.
All right. Well, we'll talk with more with Dr. Peter Kalmus. His book is Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. We'll get the take from Dr. Kalmus, who's an atmospheric scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, about how much human activity is contributing to this issue. We'll talk more after this time out on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is our producer, and the number for our show is 877-217-5757, wherever you are, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. You can always send an email anytime, any place, to talk@talklouisiana.org. A few more minutes with Dr. Peter Kalmus, atmospheric scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's speaking as an individual about climate change, and it is an issue that certainly is gaining more relevance by the day. Once again, 877-217-5757. We'll go back to the phone lines in just a moment with Dr. Peter Kalmus. How much of this, in your judgment, and based on the fact that, as I said, you practice what you preach with about one-tenth the average fossil fuel consumption of an American, how much of it is human activity as far as the culprit for the issues we're having?
Yeah, so 100% of it is from human activity. So it comes mostly from burning fossil fuels and emitting CO2. It also comes from a few other greenhouse gases that we're emitting, notably methane. And then it also comes from changes in the land, for example, clearing forest, which emits carbon that's caught in the trees, that's tied up in the trees. You know, actually, Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist in Texas, pointed out something that I thought was quite interesting, that you can actually say that more than 100% of it's caused by humans, because over the last few decades, the solar energy from the sun has been getting very slightly less. So the sun has its own cycles. So that's actually a negative forcing, so a cooling effect. So, yeah, it's all due to us.
All due to us, says Dr. Peter Kalmus. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Kalmus.
Good morning, Jim. Our Defense Department has done studies just to see what the conditions are that people can actually survive in under the conditions of extreme heat. They did an experiment in the equatorial jungles with a group of soldiers in very, very fit condition, and basically they just could not handle it. They almost died of dehydration. So we're not going to adapt our way out of this situation. And then in the past few years, there have been thousands of people who have died in the heat waves that we're experiencing now. So this is dreadfully, profoundly serious.
Thank you, Phil.
Yeah, I think it's good to remember, you know, even in light of the recent disasters. So most recently, of course, the hurricanes in the southeast, and then the fires, especially in the northwest. Those are only two particular impacts from global warming, and there's many others that we're going to begin experiencing more frequently in the coming years and decades ahead.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org to reach Dr. Peter Kalmus in our remaining time with him. Scott says, please ask Dr. Kalmus to explain how long a molecule of CO2 remains in the atmosphere and how many metric tons of CO2 humans have emitted into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. Dr. Kalmus?
Oh, wow. Yeah, so that's a hard question. The carbon cycle, CO2 has many, you know, many ways of getting into the atmosphere and many ways of coming out of the atmosphere, and those processes all happen on different timescales. So when we emit CO2, when we burn fossil fuels mainly, about half of that CO2 stays in the atmosphere, and about half of it is taken out of the atmosphere fairly quickly on a short time scale of maybe a few years or decades. And about half of that CO2 that comes out, so about a quarter of the total that we emit, goes into the ocean. So it's sort of like, the same way that you can carbonate water, we're sort of carbonating the ocean, and that's why it's becoming more acidic. And then the other half that comes out of the atmosphere is going into the land biosphere. One thing that's concerning is that both of those sinks could start turning into sources as the planet gets warmer. The ocean will hold less CO2, and as forests continue to burn, the land sink might also potentially become a source. But after a few tens of thousands of years, if we stopped burning fossil fuels, I think about 80% of the CO2 would come out of the atmosphere, and then the rest of it would start coming out on longer timescales through through processes involving the deep ocean and rock weathering. So that the timescale for that is on the order of 100,000 years or a few hundred thousand years. In terms of how much we've emitted total, that number escapes me, but I think about 80% of the total has come from burning fossil fuels and about 20% from basically deforestation, land use change.
Doug on Highland. Doug, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Peter Kalmus.
Good morning. Thanks for having this topic. It's very timely. I know a lot of folks, especially in Louisiana, are still confused about this issue, and that's not surprising because there's a whole infrastructure that's been created to confuse them. But a couple things that, your guest has been talking about, really, I think anybody should be able to grasp. One is that all the indicators that we're seeing point to the warming climate. And on the timetable that he's talking about, where humans are the causal factor, all the indicators. There are no indicators of cooling. The other thing is, if you look at the projections from all the models for sea level rise, for temperature, all of them, they don't exactly agree because the models are somewhat different, but they all go up. It's just a question of how much. So when you look at these indicators, anyone should be able to tell that this really is happening, unfortunately. And if we don't do anything about it and let the trends for emissions continue, it's going to be worse than if we do try to control them. Basic points. I think anyone should be able to grasp that.
All right. Thank you, Doug. Dr. Kalmus?
Yeah, great. That was a great comment, and it's absolutely right. I'll add that there's some concern in the community that the ensemble of climate models might be a little bit conservative because there's some processes, for example, nonlinear processes involving ice sheets moving and accelerating their melting that may not be captured in all the models accurately yet. And I think most of those uncaptured processes would potentially lead to more rapid warming than is currently predicted.
Final caller for Dr. Kalmus, Nini at LSU. Good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. First of all, I would just like to say that I'm immensely grateful that you have this guest on and that you're bringing this topic into the consciousness of the community. But I wanted to ask if Dr. Kalmus sees any hope for like carbon sequestering or other carbon removal technologies, or what areas that he thinks we should focus on to sort of, bias time or try to mitigate damage while we curb our appetite for fossil fuels?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I will preface that by saying that I personally believe that we should really be throwing most of our weight behind just simply stopping burning fossil fuels. I'm pushing individuals that get the seriousness of the problem to explore in their own lives and in cooperation with their communities, reducing their own emissions. And the reason for that is not to directly take, you know, to take a huge chunk out of the problem, but to contribute to a cultural shift, which will then make space for politicians and force them, because they're leaders, they're not followers. They're followers. I mean, they're not leaders. They follow us, the politicians, to force them to adopt policies like carbon pricing that can actually make a difference. Do I have a little more time, Jim, or should we?
We've got a roll, but thank you so much, and we'll be calling again soon. Dr. Kalmus, Peter Kalmus, the book is Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jim.
And we'll be back with Marie Constantine, one of the great photographers in the world, and she calls Baton Rouge home. Now the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We're joined by Marie Constantine. She is one of the world's top photographers, and come Thursday, she'll be inducted in the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame, the Manship School of Mass Communication Hall, along with Lou Gehrig Burnett and Alex Martin, the news editor for the Wall Street Journal. And tomorrow, Alex Martin will be a guest on our show. Marie Constantine, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
You've been doing this for a very long time.
Yeah, a long time.
And you specialize in black and white photos. You do, I know you do more than that, but is there something about black and white that brings out a story that we don't see in vivid color?
Well, actually, I mostly shoot color, but in my personal work, when it's up to me and, you know, somebody's not paying me, I like to shoot black and white. I love the black and white. I think it kind of simplifies things and just sort of brings everything down to be sort of a peaceful look.
When I say you've done this a long time, you're still a relatively young person, but you didn't start early in life. You attended LSU, graduated with a journalism degree, and then it was several years after that that you started photography. What was the catalyst for this?
Yeah, my mother was extremely artistic and my father very creative, and I felt that I didn't feel that I got their creative genes. And they needed somebody to take pictures for the LSU Catholic, and nobody in the office wanted to do it. Uh-huh. I worked there after my first degree. And so I said, well, I'll do it, you know. And I actually had to borrow a camera because I didn't have a camera. And I noticed right away that the pictures had a sense of design in it. So it kind of surprised me because I really thought I didn't have anything creative about me, you know.
Is there any special message you can convey about what makes a good shot?
I think that you have to go to that artistic side of your brain. If you're thinking, it just doesn't work. And what happens is photography requires both. It requires you to, you know, think about f-stops and things. And so that pulls you into that sort of thinking part of your brain. But composition, you need to be in that other space. And so to try to do that at the same time is complex, nor do you even understand that you need to kind of shift back and forth. And I think that's what makes photography complicated.
How is the process different, if at all, when you're shooting a person as opposed to shooting a beautiful neighborhood like your neighborhood in Spanish Town?
I think you can get a good glass of wine and walk around with your camera if you're shooting the neighborhood. No,
the neighborhood's not going to move around.
You're not going to get fired. No, you're more relaxed when you're shooting buildings. You know, it with people, it's much more difficult. You have to, you know, often people tell you, "Oh, I hate my photo." When they tell you that, then you have to realize there's something that they don't like about themselves, and so you have to try to find their angle. And then they're not relaxed because they hate their photo. And so it gets very complicated when you shoot people.
Do people look differently in photographs than they do in person? Or does generally the photography tell the story?
Yeah, they're going from 3D to 2D. And our brain makes everything okay. You know, when I look at somebody, like if I look at you, if one eye is smaller than the other, and I'm really looking at you, and I'm making everything okay, and everything's just perfect. But then when you take the picture, you go, oh, my God. And so when you actually go to take the picture, you have to think in 2D, and you have to see that. Mm-hmm. And then you have to pick an angle or maybe sculpt them with light. You know, if one eye is smaller, then you bring that eye closer to the lens, and an optical illusion is created, and they look regular again.
Well, Marie Constantine became internationally known for her photographic works of the late Mother Teresa. When the Vatican chose one of her photos to hang in St. Peter's Square for Mother Teresa's 2003 beatification ceremony, that photo from Marie Constantine was unveiled in front of more than 300,000 people. That had to be a heady experience.
That was crazy. I was up on the roof of the Vatican, and CBS Sunday Morning was, they wanted to film my reaction. But after they unveiled it, this man came up to me that was a media person, and he said, "Now what are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to go home and peel shrimp." I was actually thinking of Father Carville because he, you know, he was the vicar general, and he would be peeling shrimp and be so happy and content, and that beautiful ability to do something simple, in where in the Western world we think of that as a lesser thing, but actually, when we're with our families and you know, peeling shrimp or whatever we're doing, it's our full attention is given, and it's a very beautiful moment. We, you know, it's a shame that we say, well, this is a big deal and this is a little deal, where, you know, all of life is very special.
877-217-5757 is your number, locally 297-5633. And Marie Constantine, native of Hartford, Connecticut, is with us. She went to LSU, and after getting her journalism degree, got into photography in a big way, and that photograph of Mother Teresa that was unveiled in front of more than a quarter million, actually more than 300,000 people, caused Charles Osgood of CBS Sunday Morning to feature Marie in a six-minute piece that showed more than 25 black-and-white photos that she had made over a 13-year period. That was an experience, I'm sure, to work with Charles Osgood. He's one of the best at what he does.
Yeah, they actually, they flew down to Louisiana, and one of his producers, they filmed me down here. And then I never actually met him. That's the way they assemble the piece. And then they said, when you're in St. Peter's Square, we want to catch you over there. So a local person named Alan Peasy caught me over there. And so then they pieced it together. It kind of looked like Charles interviewed me, but he didn't.
It was on his
program. Yeah, it was on his, it was,
well,
his
anyway,
piece. Yeah.
And six minutes in television is an eternity, especially network television.
Yeah.
So it brought you to another realm as far as your notoriety, and for good reason. How was she to photograph, Mother Teresa?
She was unpredictable, and she would make quick moves. And, you know, often I was photographing her inside a building. And so in those days, you know, you would want to drag your shutter, and you'd want to be kind of on the edge of technology to make the shot nicer. And so you had to decide, well, should I risk losing the shot? Or, you know, and so she wasn't necessarily easy, and she didn't like her picture taken. And so I would try to shoot her with the long lens. And, you know, if she was outside, then I really took advantage of that because I didn't have to flash. And those are really when I got some nice photos, was outside, and her not knowing I was there because I had a long lens on, and, you know.
Why did she not like her picture taken?
I think she was just embarrassed by it all, you know. And it just, well, the flash hurt her eyes, technically. But she, I think she just, all the fuss, she liked people. She really, you know, I saw her one time with 100-some fever and get up out of bed to come see a woman whose, you know, whose husband died. And she really got, she was energized by people. But she didn't really like all the attention. That was sort of hard for her.
Marie, you've been to Calcutta?
Mm-hmm. Three times, yeah.
How was that?
That was amazing. It's, you know, I stayed in the slums. I actually didn't go to take pictures, although Sister Sylvia from the order wanted me to take pictures. But my purpose was just to go and work. And, you know, I went alone, and I was glad I went alone because it's almost like you're on retreat. And you meet all these different people from all these different countries that go, and they put in a month or 2 weeks or 3 months. And, you know, just the kind of poverty I saw. But I actually saw worse poverty in Haiti. But it was still, nonetheless, a devastating amount of poverty that we're not accustomed to seeing. And then the children on the street, that was the hardest thing to see. You know, if there was a child on the streets of Baton Rouge, we'd be slamming on the brakes. But there's so many of them, and it's so overwhelming. And the missionaries and the humanitarians do the most extraordinary job of sacrificing their own comforts in order to help people over there.
How was Haiti?
Haiti was much worse than Calcutta in terms of starvation. I didn't see, in Calcutta, people were sleeping on the streets and babies were on the streets and children, and they had little boys called beggar boys. They were on the streets. But in Haiti, I saw severe cases of malnourishment where the hair would turn orange and the stomach would be puffy. And I didn't see that in Calcutta. They may have had it, but I didn't see it. But in Haiti, mm-hmm. It was so evident. It was just a shock. And they didn't have a lot of food. And, you know, they had cut down all the trees. And so they couldn't, you know, the natural resources were disappearing quickly and the pollution was bad.
You almost became a nun, didn't you?
Yeah, I wanted to. For the longest time, it got ridiculous.
Why didn't you do it?
You know, I think when you want to be a nun and you're older, I think you have to find, your person is developed. And I think you have to find an order that kind of fits who you are, or you would be quite miserable. And I think really I sort of am a Mary Knoller at heart. And they're more freelance. They're not necessarily in a building. They're out there, you know, with the poorest of the poor, and they're out there in, you know, first responder type situations, and they are more freelance, doing things as they happen, making decisions as they happen. And I think I would have been happy with that, but to be in a more structured thing, I'm just not a structured person.
You've just finished writing a chronicle of your experiences.
Yeah, I wrote a memoir, yeah.
When will it be available?
Well, it's out now.
Yeah, well, we need to talk about Finding Calcutta, Memoirs of a Photographer, and I look forward to our next conversation about that. But a lot of that, I understand, is about nuns, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about nuns, and I wrote the book for my niece and my two nephews. I really wanted them to know about wonderful people in the world that make sacrifices for other people, and I just tried to stay focused on that. It didn't start out writing for them, and I struggled with my writing, and then I said, okay, I got to let this go, and if I write for them, I'll be okay.
Well, congratulations on your induction into the Manship School of Mass Communication Hall of Fame. And
thank you, Jim.
It's been a pleasure spending time with you, Marie Constantine.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Kurt Anderson. His book is Fantasyland, next. This is Jim Engster, and we're joined by Kurt Anderson, who is a well-known novelist and also the host of the Peabody-winning public radio program Studio 360, a co-production between Public Radio International and WYNYC. His latest work is Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. Good morning, Kurt Anderson.
Good to be here.
It's nice to talk with you. Well, we have had quite 500 years as a country, and it has culminated with Donald John Trump being the leader of the free world. How are we looking?
Well, that's everybody can make that decision on their own in terms of their politics. But I'm, in a way, I'm not real. The book really isn't about the politics of it. It's really about the fact that, as long as we're talking about, you brought up Donald John Trump. We have a guy as president who is so amazingly indifferent to the truth or falsehood or fact or fiction of things he says. He came along just as I was finishing this book, and I said to my wife at the time a year ago, "Holy smokes, this guy! It might be good for this book. It's good for our country, but it's good for this book because." All the threads I'm stretching through these 500 years are embodied by this guy whom we now have as president.
The book is appropriately titled Fantasyland, and you say that Trump's support by a large faction of Americans is evidence that a critical mass of our country has become untethered from reality. How is that?
Well, I think he is a guy, and it has been affirmed and studied and shown by many, many different reliable sources, is a guy who not only gives small and sometimes large untruths as if they are true, did as a candidate, does as a president, but talks about he once said, this is one of the things that struck me during the campaign, he said to a bunch of supporters, hey, don't trust the news, don't believe the news, just read the internet, which is exactly the problem, or part of the problem. And this idea that any assertion, factual assertion, with which you disagree, or that is inconvenient, or that is unflattering, is fake, is untrue. And conversely, that all kinds of completely unsupported and in most cases untrue conspiracy theories about President Obama not being born in the United States, about millions of illegal voters voting against him, I could go on, it turns the world topsy-turvy. I mean, that which is mostly true, provided by the despised mainstream media or academics or whatever, is deemed to be untrue because you don't like it, and all these unsupported and untrue things are called the truth. So that's where we are. And of course, part of what I talk a lot about is how the sort of fiction and reality have been blurred and merged in this country, especially by the how everything becomes entertainment. Show business has sort of infected everything. And here's a guy whose greatest fame and success really was playing himself on a television show for 15 years, and one of whose sort of prime exceptional differences as president is the degree to which he treats it like a performance, like he's playing a character, playing a role, and so that merger of performance and entertainment and in this case presidential politics and leadership is stunning to me. I mean, again, this isn't new, and that's my point, is that he didn't invent it all. He just took greater advantage of where a place direction we've been moving for a long time. I mean, ever since John Kennedy, through Ronald Reagan, through Bill Clinton, presidents have had to perform for the television cameras. And
Kurt Anderson, you say part of this goes back to 1955 in Disneyland. How so?
Yeah. Well, I love Disneyland, and I've always loved Disneyland. But part of what Disneyland was when it opened in 1955, what it became, what it didn't seem then at all. It seemed like this amazing, the greatest amusement park ever, a new kind of amusement park. But Disneyland, especially in the specific case of its entry land, Main Street USA, became a kind of prototype for the way we wanted to make real America after that, whether it was turning old parts of our downtowns into restored new places like Soho in New York or Pioneer Square in Seattle or whatever. The way we rediscovered the old parts of cities and made them kind of new, improved Never Neverland versions of themselves. The theming of everything, the theme, I mean, there weren't, when I was a child, there weren't themed restaurants, and suddenly every second restaurant is a themed restaurant where you're pretending you're in Italy or you're pretending you're in a land of robots or whatever it is. So, what began in Disneyland didn't stay in Disneyland, and this idea that everything should be themed and everything and the line between fiction and reality is blurred, again, was unique to Main Street USA originally, where, this guy wearing this straw hat, he's just like a guy in 1910 in a small town. Well, but he's really selling me stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was really influential. And again, not in altogether bad ways. And that's part of what I talk about in Fantasyland. There are happy, desirable, charming aspects that I, like everybody else in America, takes advantage of. But the problem becomes when it's just when all of the lines that used to exist pretty clearly between the fictional and the real in life and discourse are getting blurred and fuzzy, it becomes a kind of cascade where the distinction between fictional and real become out of control in all kinds of realms. Some of them that matter, some of them that aren't just fun.
Well, some people may not like it, but you say that Oprah Winfrey helped hatch Donald Trump. Can that be true?
Well, I'm afraid it is, and I'm sure she would hate that suggestion. But yeah, Oprah Winfrey, and when she had her show, when Oprah was on every day and watched by as many as 15 million Americans, very, very devoted Americans every day, she provided an extraordinary platform for all kinds of magical thinkers, people who claimed that they had been abducted by Satanists, people who claimed they'd been to outer space and back, people who claimed they'd been to heaven and back, all kinds of medical and pseudoscientific health claims that she promoted. So in that sense, she bears some responsibility for, during that amazing long run of her program and her magazine, habituating Americans to believe in magic, in fantasy, and sometimes harmful fantasy. Her protege, Dr. Oz, who still has his daily show on, I think is a real problematic character. I mean, he's America's doctor. Roper named him that, and he's America's doctor who promotes all kinds of quack medicine.
Well, the 1960s were the decade that not only produced a lot of tumult in America, but they brought to age Donald Trump and Bill Clinton, George Bush.
Yep,
three presidents, all born in the summer of 1946. By the way. But you say this do-your-own-thing mentality of the 60s is part of the reason why we are who we are today as a country. How is that?
Well, certainly, I mean, there were a couple of there are several different parts of that. One is that what we think of as the late 60s, the do-your-own-thing, find-your-own-truth, create-your-own-reality stuff of the counterculture, it ended up not being limited to, oh, I'm going to grow my hair long and get high and listen to rock and roll. It flowed out into the culture and became the kind of total new way of thinking. A kind of, again, the seeds of it were always there, the American individualism, but it never had been quite so intense and expanded and extreme as it became out of the 1960s. And, again, I said before, what started in Disneyland didn't stay in Disneyland. What started in Haight-Ashbury didn't stay in Haight-Ashbury or the Esalen Institute or wherever. Another thing, connected but not the same thing that happened in the 60s, was on college campuses and among professors and scholars and academics who just...
And I think we got a roll, but thanks to Kurt Anderson. And also do want to note a note I received from Scott Stevenson, who says that I should have used the word, should not have used the word notoriety to describe Marie Constantine's reception from her photographs of Mother Teresa. Notability would be a better word, and J.S. is correct on that. Thank you, sir. Alex Martin and Dean Baquet, the editors of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, are on tomorrow. And we'll certainly have a good discussion with them. Alex, like Marie, will be inducted into the Manship School Mass Communication Hall of Fame. Until then, for Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.